most pregnancies don't have a problem. Yet in OB world, almost all pregnancies have a problem. Somebody is not right. They both can't be true.
So many mothers are given a diagnosis of IUGR at a single visit. How can you diagnose growth restriction if you're not comparing between more than one data point?
Well, the diagnosis used to be IUGR was less than the third percentile by weight, not by the abdomen or thing. And 10th percentile was small for gestational age. But now they've sort of blurred the lines between those two. They don't care whether it's small for gestational age or IUGR. They don't feel that their intervention has any negativity.
But if you're just going because it is so delightful to see your baby, let's face it, try to talk a woman out of doing an ultrasound. But now you are responsible that you opened up a can of worms. We know if they tell you the fluid levels are low, they're going to recommend induction. We know if they find a baby they say is big, and we also know that they're wrong the vast majority of the time anyway, we know they're going to push a scheduled C-section. We know they're going to tell you it's IUGR. Well, now the best thing you can do is don't get yourself into this mess. Ultrasound has never been shown to make low-risk women any safer in decades.
I'm Cynthia Overgaard, owner of Hypnobirthing of Connecticut, childbirth advocate, and postpartum support specialist.
And I'm Tricia Ludwig, certified nurse midwife and international board-certified lactation consultant.
And this is the Down to Birth podcast.
Childbirth is something we're made to do, but how do we have our safest and most satisfying experience in today's medical culture?
Let's dispel the myths and get down to birth.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Stu.
Hi, Stu.
Welcome back.
It's always good to talk to you both.
Always nice to see your smiling eyes.
Yeah, it's been a while. We love having you.
Like, yeah, it feels like just coming to visit family.
Where are you these days?
I'm still in. I live in Southern Utah. Life is good right now on a personal level.
Wonderful. So,
I'm very happy. And this week I head to North Carolina and then on to Florida to reteach breach seminars there.
You have to make sure you let us know if you're ever in the Northeast.
Of course. Of course. I have nothing planned for the Northeast at this point. But
we could use a reteach breach conference up here. That would be great.
You know what? Every hospital in the country could use a reteach breach program.
100%.
Yeah. There's so much gaslighting going on about breech birth in the hospitals and funneling people down toward a cesarean section. And me being a lightning rod for stories about that, I get people that write me stories about, you know, they're looking for VBAC options because their first baby was sectioned for breech and they were never given any choices when that happened.
I just got, somebody just wrote to us the other day, a story about their birth center who basically is now lumping, and this is probably going on in a lot of places, they're lumping twins, breech, and VBAC all together in the high risk category. They're putting VBAC in there as, you know, midwives are not allowed to do these births. They don't have the extensive training that they need to do.
Wow. That's
VBAC. I mean, what are we talking about?
I just have to say, I've had over 150 clients have VBACs over the years. One single one was with an obstetrician. And I'm talking VBACs after up to 4 C-sections, after 1, 2, 3, and 4. And every single one, except for one, was with a midwife.
At home?
Half right. Were at home. And it's not that those women wanted home births. They felt they had no other option and they were committed to a vaginal birth. They were scared to have home births in most cases. They didn't want one the first time around. So the second time around, they had even less belief in their bodies. They had more to overcome. But it's been quite an observation for me to see that they ended up realizing by the end of pregnancy, they just couldn't do it with those doctors because they were getting all the red flags and all the signals. So now to take that away from women, again, we come back to freedom every time.
It's freedom and it's also stupidity.
And control.
Because a VBAC is just a vaginal delivery. Doesn't require any special skills to do a VBAC. They're saying, well, it might require access to an operating room. Well, that's really, really rare. But yet that fear is what generates all the anxiety that goes on in the community about VBAC, because doctors may in, at some point experienced a uterine rupture, and therefore, or they're just following orders in their hospital, which says that you can't do VBACs here. And so because they consider it to be risky, they project that risk onto women, and then they lump it in with something like breech and twins, which is also not that risky, but at least requires some special skills to be able to properly take care of women who have a breech baby or twins, where more than 50% of the time, one of the twins will be in the breech presentation. But to clump VBAC in there is simply sort of
stupid.
It's an obtuse, non-thinking way of saying, essentially, like the American College of OBGYN states in one of their guidelines about influenza and pregnancy, they say this sentence, and I'm not taking it out of context, pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition.
Oh, they do not. They say that now? ACOG says that? They call pregnancy high-risk.
It's in their influenza guidelines. The second sentence in the guidelines says pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition. And then it goes on to talk about that's why you should get the flu vaccine, or that's why influenza can be worse.
So they're lumping being pregnant in with having hypertension, chronic illness, being a smoker. They're considering it a high risk.
It explains, guys, why they counsel and look at everything as being dangerous. If that's the philosophy that they have, that pregnancy itself is a high risk condition, then you can see where they're coming from. But that's crazy.
I mean, can't we just all open our eyes and see mammals giving birth all over the earth every day, like by the millions? Sometimes we just have to use our common sense. That's what guided me through so much of my work when I got into this, or even through my pregnancy when I didn't understand anything. I just kept asking what all of my ancestors did, what all the other mammals are doing. And when you hear certain things, it just simply isn't credible.
You know, it's almost like a form of agoraphobia. You know, agoraphobia is afraid to go out of your own house.
Yeah, crowds.
It's dangerous. You know, you could just see the ACOG saying life itself is a high risk condition. And yeah, you know, it is. Every day there's potential risks. But you can't, if you live your life that way, your life is not going to be very it's not going to be filled with joy very often, because you're always nervous. You're always anxious. You're always that person saying, should the baby be playing with that right now? Is it safe to keep your baby up this late? You're not vaccinating your baby. I mean, you want to expunge those people from your life, but you can't, because they're usually your relatives. So you can't get rid of
them. It's just so easy to prey on pregnant mothers because they're so protective of their babies, right? Their instinct is to be so protective, and they're so vulnerable. They will listen to what anybody says. If it means that they're putting their baby in harm's way, they're going to buy into whatever is put in front of them. So it's cruel.
It reminds me of the psychology behind, I think, the best slogan ever created by anyone. I don't know if it was New York Lotto or one of the lotteries. It was, hey, you never know. And it's like, okay, you never know. You might win the lottery, but you're more likely to be struck by lightning 7 times in your life. So let's talk when you get to 6 times, you know? But that was such a brilliant line. Hey, you never know.
Playing with your psychology.
And when a woman is pregnant, that's the same message. The same part of her brain is that you never know, but you never know. And then that's what scares her. If you tell her it's 1 in a million, she'll still think, but I could be that one. And you've got her.
Right. But they never tell you the other end of that spectrum, which is when you go to the hospital, you never know what might happen to you because you're in the hospital.
Exactly.
Right. It's like the VBAC scenario when they tell you that, you know, your baby has a 50% chance of dying if your uterus ruptures, which, first of all, you know, I don't even know where this statistic came from, but women are told that. Mm-hmm. So it's much safer if you have a C-section, yet they don't ever explain the risks of either being induced, you know, to prevent uterine rupture or repeat C-section to the baby, to you down the line. It's always only the thing that they're trying to get you to do that they're speaking about.
Well, and there's plenty of good literature in the world about if you're a healthy woman with a normal, healthy pregnancy, you're much better off staying at home. You have a lower rate of interventions. You have a lower rate of cesarean section. You have a lower rate of induction. You have a lower rate of epidural. You have a lower rate of episiotomy, lower rate of lacerations. You have a better chance of breastfeeding.
Lower rates of postpartum depression.
Yes, higher rates of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. All those things go on, but you never know.
Right.
I think that there are people that are actually manipulating people with fear, and there are other obstetricians who are honestly just so indoctrinated into that way of thinking that they're going to tell somebody at 10 weeks pregnant that, well, you're over 35, so there's a chance that your placenta will give out. So we're going to want to start testing your baby early, and we're going to want to induce you probably by 39 weeks. And you're telling this to a woman at 10 weeks, and you're telling it to every woman at 10 weeks who's over 35, not, which by the way is a stupid rule anyway, 35 doesn't mean anything. But you're telling it to every woman, never individualizing your care, never asking the woman what her needs or desires are, you're already setting them up for failure. It's the classic thing that I've talked about many times from the movie Inception, where they tell them not to think about elephants. Okay, don't think about elephants.
It's a Tony Robbins thing. You get what you focus on.
Right, and they're only focused on finding something wrong. Every time they want to do something for you, it's a revenue generator for somebody.
Of course.
So the whole system is completely busted because they're incentivizing more testing, more interventions. They should pay less.
Because natural physiologic birth pays the least. So.
And sometimes it requires the most skill, and that's the skill of doing absolutely nothing.
It requires the most time. That's for sure. Time. Patients' ability to sit and wait and do nothing, which doesn't pay. So the more we do, the more money we can make. And now it's just become, there's always something. It's age over 35, your blood pressure is borderline high. Now it's just this constant for every woman, your baby's too small. And this movement toward the baby is better off outside the uterus by 38 weeks than it is in the uterus. They can find a reason for every woman. Any woman who enters the system, they will come up with a reason why your baby should be born a few weeks early.
Well, when they do ultrasounds on you in the last trimester, especially in the last month or 6 weeks, they've actually looked at that, and they found that there's a 20-some percent higher rate of induction or cesarean section simply because you had an ultrasound that you didn't need. At 36 or 37 weeks, because they'll find something. The fluid will be lowish. The baby's measurements will be asymmetrical. The placenta will be a grade 3. Oh my God. They'll find something to start.
The cord
this
is around
cascade.
The neck. So the one part.
Yeah, that's a good one.
One part of that meta-analysis that I believe you're referring to is focusing on big babies. And when you do the research, 1 in 12 women, approximately 1 in 12, about 8.5% of women have, quote, big babies. I refuse to use the word macrosomic. My babies would both qualify, and I think it's a bogus term, and I'll never use that with legitimacy. But 1 in 12 have babies over age 14. And when they give late pregnancy ultrasound to women, they tell not 1 in 12 they are looking at big babies. They tell 1 in 3 that they have big babies. And that research showed that those women were heavily coerced into scheduling C-sections the vast majority of the time and induction the rest of the time. None of them were just told, well, look at that. You've got a big baby. Good for you. Go home and enjoy. We'll see you when you go into labor. None of them. And then when all those babies were born, those supposed big babies, the average weight of those, quote, big babies was under 8 pounds. And the conclusion of that study was that a care provider's perception of a big baby is more dangerous than a big baby, because what it showed was far higher maternal complications, 4% versus 17%, and so on and so forth. Everything was worse in the category where they suspected a big baby as compared to women like me who simply had big babies. Those were much safer births.
Hey there, all you amazing, strong, and beautiful women. Especially you new moms and moms-to-be. I'm Taylor, co-founder and CEO of Vitality.
And I'm Taylor's sister, Chloe, co-founder and chief design officer.
We started Vitality to encourage and empower everyone to live a vibrant life. We're all about supporting women, especially on the journey to motherhood. When I was pregnant, I really struggled to find comfy leggings that I could wear all day, every day. So we set out to make the best maternity pants out there. We took those pain points and designed pieces that were supportive and comfortable, including details like a high-rise fit, underbelly seam, raw-cut hems, and to top it off, we have an embedded silicone panel that acts like a built-in suspension system for your low back, which is the first of its kind. So we designed this line in our Marshmallow Soft Cloud 2 fabric in not only a maternity pant, but a volley and biker short as well. Let me tell you, all of these pieces are a game changer. Just go to shopvitality.com. And cherry on top, you guys can use code DOWNTOBIRTH at checkout to get 10% off your order. 10% off athleisure, designed for pregnancy, during pregnancy.
Down to Birth is sponsored by Postpartum Soothe. Recovering from a vaginal birth takes many women by surprise. Everyday activities like sitting, walking, and going to the bathroom can be uncomfortable. And Postpartum Soothe is just the remedy to support your healing and relieve discomfort. Postpartum Soothe is a 100% organic herbal blend that's applied to maternity pads in the days immediately following your birth, giving you all the benefits of a sitz bath 24/7. That's because herbs like comfrey leaf, uva ursi, and witch hazel are known for their antimicrobial and anti-inflammatory properties. Postpartum Soothe can be prepared anytime during the third trimester, and it makes a beautiful baby gift. It's a must for any woman seeking a faster, easier recovery from a vaginal birth. Visit postpartumsoothe.com. That's postpartumsoothe, SOOTHE.com, and use promo code DOWNTOBIRTH. Did you know that 97% of women take a prenatal vitamin, yet 95% of us are still deficient in key nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum? After a long time searching for the optimal prenatal nutrition product, we bring you Needed, a radically better prenatal vitamin. Needed's nutritional products offer nutrients that your body can utilize with doses at optimal versus bare minimum levels and are available in capsules and an easy-to-take vanilla powder, perfect for those moms with pill fatigue or nausea. Needed is a woman-founded company offering a superior nutritional product lineup backed by research, data, and insights from nearly 4,000 women's health experts. Needed offers premium supplements for every stage, from egg quality support for women trying to conceive to lactation support for breastfeeding. And you know, Cynthia and I, we love their botanical sleep and relaxation support packets before bedtime. So if you are looking for a radically different prenatal, head on over to thisisneeded.com and enter Down to Birth for 20% off your first order.
And they use the idea that a big baby will lead to, like, it'll get stuck or there'll be a shoulder dystocia. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's not true. First of all, there's very little correlation between having an 8 or 9 pound baby and shoulder dystocia. Secondly, that's why you're an obstetrician. If there is a shoulder dystocia, you're trained to handle a shoulder dystocia. But shoulder dystocia has become like screaming fire in a crowded theater. You know, you mentioned that to somebody and you said it earlier, Trish. You said, if you can scare a woman about her baby, she's going to err on the side of caution, which is another phrase that Bliss and I like a lot, because what that really means is that you're making a mistake to be cautious. But it sounds like a good statement.
Small babies are at risk of shoulder dystocia as well. It isn't just the big babies that get stuck at the shoulders. It has a lot more to do with maternal position and baby's position than size.
And epidurals.
Epidurals, yeah. Being on your back, not being able to be upright and moving and allowing your baby to optimally navigate the pelvis.
Right. And these are all things that are done to women, not necessarily for women. A small, small percentage of women need interventions, but most women do not. But the medical model doesn't understand that. Because, as I've said 1,000 times, all that matters to them, really, when you boil it down, is a live baby in the bassinet. And how the baby gets in that bassinet is not their concern. And what happens to that baby, that mother, and that mother's future babies at that moment is not their concern. They may, on a personal level, feel that way, but the medical model doesn't feel that way. The medical model is an assembly line. It's, you know, there's lots of analogies. It's a hamster wheel and they can't get off. And everyone who comes in is treated exactly the same. You're asked the same questions. You're drawing the same bloods. You're peeing in the same cup. Well, hopefully different cups, but you're peeing in a cup. You're changing into a hospital gown. You're asked to be on your back. You put belts on your belly. Even doesn't matter if you're coming in for your fifth baby and you feel like pushing, or you're coming in for your first baby, or you're 38 or you're 22. They treat you all the same. And now that we have a system which is going away from individual practitioners to shift mentality, to the laborist mentality, there's very little relationship that goes on between them. So you have the very unconnected. And then you also have the idea that a lot of doctors are not very happy with the system as it is, but they feel helpless to do anything about it. And when you're unhappy and you're working a shift and you meet somebody who doesn't conform to your way of thinking, it's very hard to be nice to them because you don't have the patience for it. You're just working your shift and you don't know this person. And this person's telling you, you know, that's not what the literature says, or they're contradicting you, and you're tired and you've been up and you have, again, you have no relationship to this person. So you end up having these conflicts that you see all the time. It's really rare, from my experience in both worlds, hearing from a woman who writes into me that I had this conflict with my midwife. It happens, but nowhere to the extent, because midwives and their patients have relationships. And when you have relationships, you work it out, or you find out early on that this isn't the relationship for me. And, you know, they say that finding a midwife is like dating. You want to find somebody that's compatible for you and somebody that listens to you and that you feel comfortable and doesn't raise, as you guys like to say, the red flags. And you can do that in the midwifery model. But the medical model, you get whoever is on call.
And I will say that I think midwives in the medical model are more like the doctors than they are like midwives, just from observation.
Because they've been groomed by the system. They are indoctrinated into the system, and now they have to start kind of following the protocols and policies of the hospitals. But, you know, there is actual evidence out there to show that continuity of care is a major factor in the safety of birth, that women who have continuous care with the same provider throughout pregnancy and birth have less intervention and safer births. Yet.
And also you talked about midwives in the hospital. It's happening to midwives at home a lot too, because a lot of them, depending on how they're trained, because some of the midwifery schools now are becoming more and more medicalized. And so they're coming out, even the CPM, or what we call LMs, licensed midwives. And then depending on what state they're in, the tyranny of the regulatory state is such that it scares the crap out of midwives, because they want to help this woman, but they're putting their career and potentially their freedom on the line because the state has a policy that was put in place by people who really don't understand birth, lobbied by people who have a financial incentive to keep birth medicalized and in the hospital. And so you end up with states that say, oh, midwives can't do this without doctor consultation, or you can't take care of somebody at 36 weeks and 6 days if she's in labor.
Or you can't have your home birth if you go past 42 weeks. And a very high percentage of women go past 42 weeks in the care of home birth midwives. My own friend, Nancy Wehner, who's the expert in VBAC, she had three women one July. They were all VBAC moms. They all went past 42 weeks, all in the same month. I mean, it's really not uncommon, and it's so unfair to the mother to have that fear, like this dramatic opposing birth looming over her if she simply goes past 42 weeks. And then the midwife is rendered totally helpless over the situation.
Yeah, and the midwife ends up doing things she wouldn't normally
Loopholes,
do.
Like, exactly.
Like cervical sweeps, which I have a letter from somebody here about a cervical sweep and all the problems it caused, or castor oil or other things that they would not normally do.
Or fudging medical records.
They're taking matters into their own hands because they're put into one unethical situation, which is going to lead to others. Then those women are going to look to take their power back and say, well, forget this. I'm not going to abandon this woman I've had a relationship with all these months when I can simply fudge the due date. But that's what this leads to, because like you said, Stu, these decisions are made by those who don't know the first thing. They're in this position of oversight. They don't know the first thing about birth. They shouldn't be in those positions to make those decisions.
Yeah. One of my major pet peeves about the whole tyrannical regulatory system is that the same bodies that educate you as a midwife or as a resident in OBGYN, and then you come out and you take a bunch of testing and then you get licensed to practice, but then they tell you how to practice. It's like, I'm licensed to be a physician. You guys have approved me through years of residency training or midwifery school to be competent, to be able to make good decisions. And then I come out and then you don't let me make decisions. You tell me how to practice. It's very frustrating because there are people that want to practice very rigid, follow every ACOG guideline, every CDC guideline. And there are women who want those kind of practitioners. But there are other people that want to individualize. We want to listen to what the woman wants and her desires and maybe be a little more flexible. And the regulatory bodies say we can't, even though we went through all this training. Whoever they is, think they know best for all women and all the people practicing. And so they're going to make one size fits all, because it's about control. And when you want to control something, you need to control it, because you hate the idea that people are individuals. And there's a big problem with the system. That's why I said at the beginning, you come into the hospital, you're the questionnaire they're asking you guys is the same questionnaire that if you came in with a appendicitis or a gunshot wound, they'd be asking you the same questions. How many stairs do you have in the house? What did your grandmother die from? Do you have any tattoos or piercings? I mean, does this really matter to a pregnant woman coming in labor? But no, you have to do it because somebody in a cubicle in the administrative office or risk management says we have to do the same thing all the time to all people. And this is where the system completely breaks down. And that's why we end up with dissatisfaction rates that are extremely high. C-section rates over one-third of women having C-sections. Induction rates of 30, 40, 50%. In England, their stats just came out of England, and they have less than 50% of women went into spontaneous labor. I think it was 43%.
They're following our model. When they have lower maternal mortality, like every other
had a better model.
They're all better. But I always feel like the trend is the other countries become more like this. I know they just start modeling our poor example. So one thing that I'd love to get your take on is the unquestionable trend in IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction. This is something I never heard about in the first 15 years that I did the work that I do. And now we hear about it constantly. And I just would love to get your take, whether you're hearing about it all the time, I assume you are. And, you know, just the whole difference between that and small for gestational age. Tricia has commented on it a bunch of times, and we've touched on it in a few episodes, but what's the lowdown on this?
Finding the perfect pregnancy and breastfeeding bra is no easy task. Your search is now over. Meet Davin and Adley, a mother-owned pumping, nursing, and maternity bra company with a unique, comfortable, and stylish cropped cami. This item is perfect to wear all day long from day one of your pregnancy right through the end of your breastfeeding journey and probably beyond. The Amelia cami makes pumping and breastfeeding easy while looking and feeling good on your body. It works seamlessly for both wearable pumps and flange pumps, and you can breastfeed in it. It also has a beautiful stretch lace back. You can sleep in it, dress up in it, go out in it, whatever you want to do in it. And trust us, the quality in this item and all of their items are top notch. They're soft, durable, and attractive. These bras will truly go the distance. Davin and Adley carry a gorgeous selection of maternity and nursing wear, and they have an innovative one-piece breast pad that we've never seen anywhere else. So no more losing those solo breast pads, ladies. Go ahead and check out the full collection of maternity and nursing items at davinandadley.com and use your promo code DOWNTOBIRTH to save 15%. All right, breastfeeding moms, do you want to know one of our all-time favorite items for your nursing journey? If you know us, you probably could guess it. Yep, it's the Silverette Nursing Cup. These little nipple heroes not only protect, but also heal because they're made of real silver. It is naturally antimicrobial, antifungal, and anti-inflammatory. These little cups will be your best friend in the early sensitive weeks of breastfeeding your baby. And our favorite part is they last literally forever. You can pass them on just like you would a favorite piece of jewelry. Head on over to silverettesa.com and use promo code DOWNTOBIRTH to save 15%.
Well, let me start by reading you a letter that I got this morning.
Oh, okay.
And then I do want to get into it because the definition of IUGR is fuzzy.
Yeah.
And you can use a definition any way you want. And if you want to get people to be induced and stuff, then you'll use a definition that is rather liberal for, if that's the word I can use for that. But this is a letter from Justine. And she says, "Hi, Dr. Fishbein." This kind of stuff I get like all the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We do too.
"Wondering if you can give me your opinion. I have a mama having her second baby." So this is a practitioner, a midwife. "I have a mama having her second baby with me at home this year. And her first was IUGR. You and I can agree most cases of IUGR are overdiagnosed and overmanaged." So she's aware. "Mm-hmm. It was recommended to her to take a baby dose of aspirin for this whole second pregnancy to prevent a second IUGR baby." First of all, maybe they asked her questions about her baby. Maybe they asked her why the baby was supposedly diagnosed as IUGR when this was recommended to her by some MFM. But I suspect the MFM hears IUGR with first pregnancy, baby aspirin with second pregnancy. No idea. Not even checking to see if the IUGR was an accurate diagnosis. Let's continue. Okay. So she says, Justine says, "My gut tells me that it's not necessary, but I told her I would consult with an OB and see what they say. Any thoughts would be graciously appreciated." So I wrote back. This was this morning, actually. "You are on target with the overcalling of IUGR. Do we know what her first baby weighed? How many weeks was she? Why baby was IUGR, if it was IUGR? The default of most OBs is to intervene without investigating, and they think aspirin is innocuous anyway." So they think that by giving an aspirin is like the snake oil. It cures what ails you. And they give it no matter what, and they think it's innocuous. And whether it is or it isn't, it's an intervention, and we don't know what the use of aspirin will do to that mom or that baby 10 years from now or 20 years from now, because no one looks, no one cares. It has done some good things, as you said. It does reduce the risk of recurrent preeclampsia in some women, like 20-some% decreased risk, which actually isn't that great.
The absolute risk is even lower. It's really low.
Good.
The absolute risk is very low. But also, you're right. They haven't studied that enough. And I can't believe how they do treat it as innocuous. But they do know that moderate to high levels of aspirin are not safe. And you always have to wonder, if there's anything that isn't safe with moderate to high levels, how do we assume that low is necessarily safe? We don't know where that needle starts to move, where suddenly you're in unsafe territory. And to take anything daily for almost a year is really quite a significant recommendation medically.
At least it's cheap.
that's true. They're not making money off the aspirin.
No, they're not making money off the aspirin. Okay, but they're making money off their surveillance. So
yes.
It's the psychology of prescribing. It's the psychology of letting her think something is wrong. It's the psychology of control.
It's the idea that if there is something that we can do that's potentially harmless to reduce the risk of late pregnancy complications, we're going to do it because it's also liability.
Okay, so here we go. So she writes back and she says, "The baby was 4 pounds, 14 ounces at birth. And that was at 37 weeks and 2 days. So if you consider a baby's on the smaller side, but if you would have let her go another 2.5 weeks, that baby would have been close to 6 pounds.
Or maybe 5 weeks and she would have had a 7-pounder.
Right. So is a 6-pound baby at term growth restriction? It's in the normal range. If you look at it's greater than the third percentile. But
it's SGA, but it's not necessarily IUGR.
Correct. And it may not even be SGA because of another factor. So she says, at the ultrasound at her 32 weeks, her abdominal circumference was measuring small, under the fifth percentile.
All right. What is this? You have to explain.
The rest of her growth was on track. Length was above average, if I recall. I don't even know they do length in utero, but and overall numbers combined her out at the, in the 25th percentile. So if you add in the head, the head circumference, the femur, and the abdomen, the baby was in the 25th percentile. Yet she was deemed IUGR because the abdomen was smaller, so she was called asymmetric IUGR. But there's no evidence here that they, you know, looked for any other indication. Was there oligohydramnios? The overuse of color Doppler flow is one of my bugaboos, but was there any problem with the blood flow in the baby's middle cerebral artery or umbilical artery or the mother's uterine artery or any of the ratios that they look at? Probably not. But yet they, she was born at 37 weeks and two. I got to believe that she was induced. Okay, so she goes on and says, Mama did get a low positive test for one type of antiphospholipid antibody. But the next test in a couple months later was normal. So she doesn't have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which is a whole other discussion another day. The child is normal now at age two. Child was normal at age zero too,
right.
Does the curve, the Hadlock curve that they use for ultrasound to determine, take into the account the genetics of the parents? You're both shaking your head. So that's good for radio, but. No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Plus, we know that there's a huge amount of inaccuracy between ultrasound techs in measuring these lengths. I mean, how are we really, can we really accurately measure an abdomen?
No. Right? Well, there's an error in the scan. But IUGR is not simply something that goes by a number. All right? The question is, how is the baby growing overall?
Right.
And what I consider to be more worrisome is a baby that's, say, at the 50th percentile at 30 weeks, and at 36 weeks is at the 14th percentile.
And dropping.
Then a baby that's at 8th percentile at 20 weeks, 8th percentile at 30 weeks, 6th percentile at 36 weeks, that baby's growing beautifully. It just happens to be on the small end of the bell-shaped curve. And by the way, just remember what a bell-shaped curve is shaped like. Shaped right. Like a bell.
Right. We're not all supposed to be in the middle. There must be outliers within the curve. There must be.
Mm-hmm. So when they say, well, the baby's environment is fine, the baby's head and femur are fine, but the baby's abdomen a little small. Okay, fine. So if you're worried about the baby's growth falling off a little bit, do you have to deliver that baby? No.
Right.
You could watch that baby.
So many mothers are given a diagnosis of IUGR at a single visit. How can you diagnose growth restriction if you're not comparing between more than one data point? It has to be over time to be considered restrictive.
You can't plot a curve with one point.
But that's happening to so many mothers. One time, one visit, you have IUGR. We're scheduling your induction next week.
Or we're going to bring you in twice a week and we're going to charge you, you know, several hundred dollars a visit to come in twice a week. And then we'll allow you to go to 39 weeks. That's what they'll say. We'll allow you to go to 39, but we don't want you to go past 39 weeks. Well, why not? Why would you not allow them to go past 39?
Yeah.
Well, the rate of stillbirth, right? Well, not if there's not any.
I'll tell you why. They're afraid she's going to go into labor on her own if they go any longer than that. The odds just get too darn high. What I wish they would do, and what I hope is coming in the future, is instead of this IUGR diagnosis being based on, you know, for us only to know once a baby is born, well, it looks like that one actually did have it. Well, it looks like that one didn't really have it. Oh, well, we did our best. I feel like the second step should be saying to the mother, let's talk. Like, do you smoke? Do you have a history of smoking? Do you have an autoimmune disease? Do you have risk factors? Have you smoked pot? Are you doing drugs? Let's talk. Is there something else? What's your diet like? What are you eating?
How much did you weigh when you were born?
Yes. How much did you weigh when you were born? Exactly. I feel like that's the direction this needs to go, because that can actually point to whether there is risk. We don't just look at IUGR in and of itself, but is IUGR indicative of a risk that there is some disease in her body or some poor caretaking? But if there isn't, if there's neither, then what is the risk of IUGR? That this baby is just absolutely going to stop growing? Well, that's like you both said. Then we watch. We go
there's
to
this idea. Visit. There's this idea, I think, in their mind that it's safer to induce and have the baby be born by 37, 38, definitely by 39 weeks, than to risk the extra weeks of pregnancy. That is a greater risk. I see these babies that were induced at 37 and 38 weeks weighing 5.5 pounds, and these mothers who are now disappointed in their birth experience, and now they can't breastfeed their baby because they were born too soon and they're too small to, you know, have the efficiency that they would otherwise have if they had a couple more weeks of gestation.
Now they're born in a crisis situation. That's what we're doing to these mothers and babies.
Yes.
They're born. It's not like, oh, phew, now the baby is out. It's like, hello. Well, if you were so concerned about this baby being small, now what are we doing that the baby is out? Now we have to focus on feeding the baby and building up the baby. And we know they're going to be born with a breastfeeding issue.
So they're saying feed them formula.
I know with twins that when you induce twins at 36 to 37 weeks, which is often recommended in the medical model, not in ours, you may decrease the risk of stillbirth by a tiny percentage. And that stillbirth risk is blown way out of proportion. It's still far less than 0.5%, even at 40 weeks with twins who are uncomplicated. But if twins go into labor at 39 weeks, the ones that are induced at 36 to 37 weeks have a threefold greater risk of going to the NICU than if you let them go to 38 or 39 weeks.
Wow.
Now, again, threefold is a relative risk number. As people know, when we talk about it, you talk about it, you know, you actually need actual risk. The actual risk is moderately high in a hospital setting that has a NICU. Because what's the point of having a NICU in a hospital setting? It's to get babies to fill it up. That's what's going on. And here's an interesting thing about the diagnosis of IUGR. A lot of maternal fetal medicine doctors will use the diagnosis of less than the 10th percentile.
Right. Yeah.
Which is not a diagnosis that I was taught. Doesn't make sense to me.
Nope.
Because here's a good question for those math whizzes out there. How many babies are less than the 10th percentile?
10%. 10%. It doesn't take a math whiz.
Okay. Are 10% of babies growth restricted?
No.
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 Right. So it doesn't add up. It's, again, common sense wins. What did you learn back in the day? You were an obstetrician for 20 years.
Oh, I learned it all medicalized too. Oh, yeah. I would have been doing what these people are doing.
But it's gotten more rhetorical now. Now it's more of this catch-all, the 10% thing.
Well, the diagnosis used to be IUGR was less than the third percentile. By weight, not by abdomen or thing, but overall by the weight charts. And 10th percentile was small for gestational age. But now they've sort of blurred the lines between those two. And since all they care about is getting the live baby in the bassinet, they don't care whether it's small for gestational age or IUGR. They don't feel that their intervention has any negativity.
That's
because they don't even counsel you about the downsides of induction. I mean, they may, but they couch it in such a bias that they're telling you that, well, it's the lesser of two evils, and therefore this is something that you should do. But they don't tell you the risks of Cytotec or the risks of Pitocin instead of oxytocin, or the risks of the discomfort and the fact that you need to be monitored and then you won't be allowed to eat, and that you probably will end up with an epidural, which will then disconnect you from your baby. And then the baby will not like it, and the baby will get in distress and will have this thing called category 2 fetal heart rate tracing, which no one really understands. And the baby will be diagnosed with fetal intolerance to labor, and they'll do a C-section and they'll come and get a baby out that's screaming with Apgars of 9 and 9. And they'll say, gee, thanks. Aren't we great? We solved the problem. We got you a screaming baby, Apgars of 9 and 9.
And the mother will believe it.
Stu, what was that fleeting cynical comment you made earlier about the goal of...
Which one?
Which one? The one where you said the goal of the neonatal intensive care unit is to fill it. Can you comment on what you were indicating there, what you're saying? It's a profit center of the hospital.
It's a profit center for the hospital.
Yeah, because we've heard from so many women who can't get their babies out. Once they're in, they can't get them out. And it's days and days. Well, we need more observation. Well, now the baby has to do this.
The baby fails one test and they get 5 more days.
And now we need to wait for the baby to poop again. And it's days. And the couples go out of their mind with anxiety and they feel trapped. They really start to have notions like they're never going to get their baby. It's terrible what they're doing.
Yeah, the policies are set up to find a way to keep the baby in the NICU, like even the car seat policy. The baby has to, you know, they have to sit in a car seat for what, I don't know, 60 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever. Some people live 6 minutes from the hospital, but they have to be in the car seat. And if they fail it, then they have to be in there for another 24 hours.
Or you leave AMA, right? You leave against medical advice.
And then you have to deal with the fact that they'll call Child Protective Services on you.
That's insane.
And they won't let you leave with your baby in a car seat. So now you're leaving with your baby in your arms and you're walking home. I mean, if they see you with your baby in the car seat, they're going to stop you. It's so difficult for the mothers who have had NICU babies to make the transition from the NICU feeding schedule to a physiologic breastfeeding schedule. It's so ingrained in their brain how, you know, this baby has to feed a certain amount every 3 hours, not more than 8 times a day, not more than this amount, and at exactly this amount, when breastfeeding works nothing like that. And they can't let go of the idea that they don't know how much their baby's getting at every feeding because they've been so afraid of the time in the NICU that the baby's not eating enough or growing enough or their baby's too small, or it's just really traumatizing. And just like, you know, the OB is only concerned about the healthy baby in the bassinet after, and in the NICU, they're only concerned about the baby growing and meeting their goals while they're staying in the NICU. Nobody is thinking about what happens to that mom and baby when they leave the hospital. It's just like, okay, bye. Good luck.
Yeah. It's also the fact that they believe that that baby is, that they care more about that baby than the parents do.
Exactly. As if.
And you have to realize, again, this whole thing boils down, every aspect of our life, but specifically the medical system, boils down to money. And there's no money if a woman has a home birth for the hospital. There's no money if a woman comes in and says, I don't want an epidural, I don't want an IV, I don't want my blood drawn. So they coerce you into thinking that you have to have your blood drawn. Well, if you have to have your blood drawn, then how come women at home can birth without having their blood drawn? How does that even work? And, you know, if you have to have an IV or at least just a saline lock, you know, we have to have access just in case. What was the term you guys used at the beginning of the podcast? It wasn't just in case. It was.
Yeah. Hey, you never know.
Oh, you never know. Right. I want to write that down. So, yeah. So you have to have an IV because you never know. And then you can't really eat anything because, God forbid, you might get anesthesia, general anesthesia, which is what, 1 in 100,000 births. And you might vomit, and that's even rarer. And therefore, we can't feed you. And that's something out of the 1950s. That still sticks around. And, you know, some hospitals are changing and
they changed that in 2015, the American Association of Anesthesiologists or the American Academy of, they changed that in November of 2015. They said, oh, look at this. Lo and behold, they were 70 years late. They said, lo and behold, women can eat in labor. And since then, hospitals have hardly made any change at all. In the vast majority of American hospitals, they're still telling women that they can't. Of course you can, women listening, you can eat whatever you want. You have for the freedom to, but they're uninformed. It's really scary. We don't, and this is the thing, we always have to question ourselves, like, are they unethical or are they ignorant? I had a couple years ago who, after learning about delayed cord clamping in my class, they came back to the next class and said, Cynthia, we spoke to our doctor about wanting to do delayed cord clamping. And the doctor's response was, what do you mean you want to wait until the cord stops pulsating? If it stops pulsating, it means the baby is dead. Can you believe this? I mean, and all I've been left to wonder
did
the doctor truly not know? Either one is unforgivable. He's either that unethical and manipulating them, or he's that ignorant and doesn't deserve anyone's business.
Well, what about the doctor who says, well, we can't hand you the baby because the baby can't be above the level of the placenta because the blood will flow out of the baby back into the placenta. And right. There's one where that's actually on, somebody caught that on video where a doctor was saying that too. Think about that for a second. If you have a placenta previa and you stand upright all pregnancy, your baby will have no blood.
They've done the research on this. It strongly pulsates against gravity, and it's ridiculous that we even had to do the research, but they did do the research on it. It's proved. It goes against gravity, as blood does throughout the body.
It goes
right into the baby's liver. And the idea that it can flow back into the mother, it's in the baby's liver. It doesn't just flow back.
So where do these doctors come up with these ideas? Like you said, are they either intentionally doing this, or are they just ignorant? Part of me believes both, and part of me believes they're delusional. They create some scenario in their mind, or they did when they were a resident, and it implants in their brain, and they cannot navigate around it. So here's a good question for you guys, back to the IUGR thing. Is what does a woman do when she's told that her baby has IUGR by her physician or by the maternal fetal medicine doctor that her physician routinely sends them to? When I was growing up, maternal fetal medicine doctors were consultants who took care of problems when they were discovered by their OBs. Now they've become essentially a routine part of prenatal care that almost no OB will no pregnant woman will make it through a pregnancy, even a perfectly normal one, without being at some point referred to a maternal fetal medicine doctor, even if it's just for the 20-week scan. And once they get sort of into that system, there are things that can happen. So what does a woman do when she's given this one-time ultrasound and said, wow, I think your baby might be growth restricted? She can't really, how does she seek a second opinion in a system where everyone thinks the same? What does she do? What do you guys recommend? I see Cynthia's got chomping at the bit there.
I'm chomping at the bit. Because of that meta-analysis we referenced earlier with respect to low fluid levels in big babies, and because of this IUGR trend, and it is a trend, it's not that it doesn't ever happen, but it is a very powerful trend. I think the best advice for the vast majority of women is think long and hard before going for a third trimester ultrasound. Why are you doing it? If you have a reason, this is what I tell my clients, if you have a reason to do it, for example, you
were in a car accident,
had placenta previa really close to the cervix, they need to clear it. You have a breech baby, I just did that episode in October on my birthday. My husband manually turned into a breech baby, but before that, with the help of an expert midwife, it's kind of a long, funny, unusual story, but we knew where the placenta was. We knew the cord wasn't an issue. When you have a reason to do it, yes, now it makes sense. But if you're just going because it is so delightful to see your baby, let's face it, try to talk a woman out of doing an ultrasound because it's so awesome to see the baby. But now you are responsible that you opened up a can of worms and now you got yourself into a mess. And now how are you going to get yourself out of this mess? We know if they tell you the fluid levels are low, they're going to recommend induction. We know if they find a baby they say is big, and we also know that they're wrong the vast majority of the time anyway, not that that's linked to worse birth outcomes anyway, we know they're going to push a scheduled C-section. We know they're going to tell you it's IUGR. Well, now the best thing you can do is don't get yourself into this mess. Every woman before you since the beginning of time got through this without ultrasound. Ultrasound has never been shown to make low-risk women any safer in decades. So you're asking us how to get out of the mess. All I can say is let's try to not get into it in the first place.
I think it's very simple. If you do end up with a third trimester ultrasound, which so many mothers do for this, that, or any reason that they are convinced that they need it. Dr. Steve's giving me the money sign. Yes, they make money. If you get a diagnosis of IUGR, ask for time. Do not accept a single data point as a diagnosis of IUGR. Ask for more time. See what happens over time. That ask what the true risk is of reevaluating this in a week or two and move on.
Find out also a little bit more if you can about the person that your OB, first of all, as you guys always say, make a good choice in your OB that you're picking to begin with. Don't pick somebody just because they've been doing your pap smear for 10 years. See how you feel, the red flag issue, but also find out who that doctor uses for their maternal fetal medicine and do some investigating long before you ever have to go there. Find out about that group. It's sometimes hard to do, but you can start to investigate that group and find out. And most pregnancies don't have a problem. Yet in OB world, almost all pregnancies have a problem. There's a disconnect somewhere in there. Somebody is not right. They both can't be true. And I would lean on the fact that most pregnancies don't have a problem. And if they even put their hands on you and use a tape measure, which it's surprising how many OBs don't even do that anymore.
Right.
They go right to the ultrasound machine because it's right next to the exam table. Oh. And a woman knows her body really well, and she knows when her baby is growing or when things don't seem right or the baby's movements have changed. So if they take the tape measure at 35 weeks and you're measuring 34 centimeters, that's perfectly fine. Right? 33 is perfectly fine. But if at 2 weeks later, you're still 33, then that might be something worth checking into. But ultimately, babies shift positions. Fundal height is very, it's not
quite subjective.
Doesn't have a high specificity. Let's put it that way. So it doesn't really tell you a whole lot. I mean, it's sort of a clue, but don't let them tell you that I think your baby's small because it's 1 or 2 centimeters behind. And that's a reason to do that ultrasound that Cynthia said earlier. We should really be careful about taking a recommendation because doctors have a power over you that they can convince you that you need to have these tests done.
And the fact of the matter is it's linked to worse birth outcomes. This isn't just us all on a bandwagon to say, always go for the most natural thing possible in all instances. This is what is linked to safer outcomes for mother and baby. And that's why we take this position. As I wrote in one of my published articles, this isn't just about vaginal birthing for the joy and gratification of it, though that should not be discounted. This is because it is the safer approach to birth.
That's and we're issue. Talking about low risk pregnancies.
Exactly, which is very clearly.
Well, yeah, then we could go off on a tangent about the definition of low risk pregnancies.
Right. That's
where,
true, too.
Where is that line?
That is true.
Not all breaches are the same. Not all diabetics are the same. Not
age 35 is not high risk.
Oh, right. Yeah. Advanced maternal. Right.
So the term high risk itself it inflicts risk because once you label somebody with a label, again, it's don't think about elephants.
Right.
One of my classic things is a 20-week scan where they find that everything is perfect, but there's a single, and the woman's had a normal NIPT test, non-invasive prenatal testing. It's a blood test that's done between like 10 to 12 weeks. It shows you baby doesn't have any of the major trisomies. It can tell you the sex of your baby, that sort of thing. And then at 20 weeks, she has a perfectly normal ultrasound, except they see a isolated echogenic left ventricular focus, which is a tiny little calcification in the heart. As an isolated finding, it means absolutely nothing. And the OB may, the MFM or the ultrasound tech might even say, this doesn't mean anything, but we want to see you back in 6 weeks just to be sure that it's gone. So what is the woman taking home from this perfectly normal ultrasound? There's something wrong with my baby's heart.
Yeah, she's not going to sleep for 6 weeks.
6 weeks, she's secreting cortisol, adrenaline, and stressing, and Googling, and
visualizing the outcome she doesn't want, which is also linked to, this is also what happens in life. What we visualize is also more likely to occur. And that's dangerous in itself. It's like all the doctors who schedule C-sections at 28 weeks because the baby is, quote, breech at 28 weeks. Let's just not take any chances and get that C-section scheduled in case that baby doesn't turn head down.
Why are you even telling someone that the baby is breech at 20 weeks is an issue?
And then she's convinced her baby will stay breech. And I swear there's a correlation.
The problem with the current medical system is that these things are not going to be easily changed. You're not going to easily change the mentality of those people stuck in it. So they're not going to suddenly think to themselves, why am I telling this lady she's breech at 38 weeks or 28 weeks? I mean, then that's even a problem. I mean, I could tell her baby's breech and she'd say, yeah. And a lot of babies are breech. A third of babies are breech at 28 weeks. It doesn't mean anything. They're not going to suddenly start to counsel women differently. One, because they don't know anything. Two, because they don't have the time in their model to do it. So this has been a major bugaboo of mine that I've seen because of my experience of living in both worlds and actually being that kind of physician for the first few years that I came when I came out of residency, being very medicalized and interventionist leaning, and then gradually backing away. But it took me a long time to do that. It's not going to happen in the medical model. There's too many pressures on the practitioners to conform to whatever the system wants to say. So that's people need to know ahead of time. If you're going to go to a medicalized doctor, you're going to have to deal with some of these things. So make good decisions about choosing somebody who feels good to you. And whether or not you can afford it or not, sometimes going outside of your network, or sometimes going outside of your state, or sometimes having concurrent care, avoid the things that are scary. This is your pregnancy and it's your baby, not the hospitals, not the MFMs. And, occasionally they're right. And if you have trust in your doctor, then you'll believe them when they tell you there's a problem. But if you don't have trust, and I don't know how nowadays anybody has trust in the medical system. I don't. I don't trust anything that I read that comes out of the CDC or the FDA or ACOG. I have to look at it really critically. Sometimes they're right, and it's usually about something innocuous. It's not usually about something controversial. When it comes to controversial stuff, they're almost always wrong. And if somebody is consistently wrong, why are you continuing to trust them? And the medical model has been consistently wrong in treating everyone as if, like ACOG says, pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition. But you have to find a way to make this an enjoyable experience, because it's better for you.
Thanks for joining us at the Down to Birth Show. You can reach us at Down to Birth Show on Instagram or email us at contact@downtobirthshow.com. All of Cynthia's classes and Trisha's breastfeeding services are held live, online, serving women and couples everywhere.
Please remember, this information is made available to you for educational and informational purposes only. It is in no way a substitute for medical advice. For our full disclaimer, visit downtobirthshow.com/disclaimer. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, hear everyone and listen to yourself.
Recording already. We haven't even done anything yet.
I know. I do that. So I'm afraid I'll forget. I'm not doing anything. Don't worry.
Okay.
I expect with someone like you, where we're going to start just chatting. I'm so afraid that I'll just never click the button. So I just chop it out. How are you doing?
Yeah, that happened to Bliss and I once, and that was enough. Right.
Exactly. There's some mistakes you make once in life.
Yeah. Oh, I'm good. I'm actually quite good.
You were so good on The Daily Show. I don't understand. Like, you just spoke in perfect sound bites. Did you get nervous?
Yeah, but not as much as you'd think.
You didn't look it.
Yeah, there was like 200 people in a live studio audience too. Well, first of all, Michelle was very gracious and easy to deal with. I got to meet her in the green room about an hour before, and then my daughter was in backstage with her coworker, and it's a topic that I had no idea what she was going to ask me. So,
wow.
And she started right off with the fear question, and that was sort of that caught me off guard for like 2 seconds.
Hmm.
And then once it starts coming out, you know, it's something that I know so well that it gets going. But yeah, you're nervous and you forget, you say things a little differently than you would have said them otherwise, or you afterwards you kick yourself because you didn't